Welcome to another edition of Lying on the Beach. I'm Steve Greenberg with
Lois Whitman Hess.
And today our extra special guest is a friend and an amazing entertainer. His name is Ron Abel. He's an award-winning composer, producer, arranger, orchestrator, conductor, and musical director whose client list is as vast as Taylor Dane to opera diva Jesse Norman. Ron has been the musical force between a lot of theatrical productions, including, just to name a few here, Rockwell, Bricktop, Queen of the Night, Undressed. He's worked on a new musical called Hazel, which is was actually launched out of Chicago. And Ron has arranged and orchestrated and conducted worldwide for artists such as Liza Minnelli, Ryan Stokes Mitchell, Lucy Arnaz, Michelle Lee, Shirley Jones, and many others. And Ron, welcome to Lying on the Beach.
Thanks. It's great to be here. I actually wish I was on the beach. That would have been really nice.
I know. That would make this podcast so much better if we actually were on the beach. But we'll have to use our imaginations.
No, we'll be fine. We'll be fine. It's in a rainy New York day, and it's a good day to do this.
Exactly. So my first question for you is, so you do both the composing, which is the sitting in the room writing the music, and then you're also on stage performing the music. So which do you like better, the writing, the kind of the backstage creating the music, or performing the music?
That is really rough. I'm going to actually quote a friend of mine, the woman that I wrote Hazel with, Lissa Levin, who's and Chuck Steffen, my partner, Chuck Steffen, who writes the lyrics. And Lissa's the book writer. We were writing Hazel at one point, and we were just the three of us in the room together. And I can't remember what caused this, but we were hysterically laughing about something we had just come up with, the three of us. And Lissa turns to us in all sincerity and says, "You realize it never gets any better than this. Not the show." It's true. The creating of it, when you love the people you're working with, when you're doing it and it works, there is nothing that can match that. I mean, being on stage is fabulous, and I love what I do. I get to play for like all these great people, and it's fun. But the creating is truly a little bit more special. It because you come up with something that will probably hopefully be around, somebody else will hear it. You know, when you're live, it's done the moment you're done, unless they're recording it for something.
Right.
But the creation is really a joy to do. It really is. And then you go back to it a few months later and you go, "What was I thinking?" Or you go, "That still holds up." There are songs that Chuck and I wrote years ago that there are still phrases that every time I play them or hear somebody sing them, I'm amazed that we wrote that together. You know
it's
what I mean?
Your creation. It's your baby.
Sometimes you forget it's yours and you hear it and you go, "Wow, I don't know what spirit possessed us to write that, or it worked so well that it still works years later." You know, we're very lucky.
So, Ron, when you're on stage, are you thinking any of this when you're hearing the music flow by, or a very famous singer or a not-so-famous singer is singing, you know, the words and the music you created? I often wonder, sitting in the audience, what is Ron thinking right now?
Well, if it's a song that I've written?
No, anything.
Oh, when I'm just playing,
right.
Basically concentrating on making sure what I'm giving the singer from the piano is enough of a basis for them to take off and do what they want. That's the whole thing. You sort of like breathe with them when you're playing. At least that's the goal, so that they feel confident enough that if they want to do something a little different, you're going to be there to back them up. That's more what you're thinking. It's like you're in the moment with them. If you let your mind go to someplace else, it's not really good.
I mean, one of the things I thought was always amazing about you, because I've seen you, you know, be the musical arranger and, you know, the orchestra for so many performers. And sometimes when they flub up for whatever reason, they sneeze, they can't remember the words, they got scared, they tripped a little bit. You are there as like, you know, the second in command, and you pick up and it just flows afterwards, that it almost looked part of the act. I don't know how you do that.
I don't know how I do it either. Thank God, it's just one of those things. Your brain goes into overtime, and you immediately have to think of saving the person.
Right.
Do you know what I mean? It's like that's your job when you're up there. It's like they're the star. Your job is to protect them at all times.
Yeah, but you're spontaneous about it. I mean, it's like, and you have a few things that you do. You go, uh-oh. I mean, what you do is you just make, like, not fun of it, but you bring the audience into the background, and everybody feels inside and loved, and then everybody, you know, raves, you know, on the performer. So it's all very fluid. It doesn't, like, feel like an interruption, like, oh, my God, let's start over. This is really
right.
A mess.
I think part of the lucky thing is that I've been doing this for so long that you realize I'm at home on stage. I'm at home behind the piano. I feel safe. I feel like I'm in control. And
what if you made a mistake?
Oh, I've made mistakes. Excuse me. There was one time I was playing for somebody at an event, and it was just me at the piano, and it was this opera singer. And right before the show, he had asked me to do something else in what I was playing, like to skip a page, or he didn't want to do the whole thing. And I said, okay, fine. When it came time for the show in front of everybody, it totally blanked from my mind because I hadn't written it down, thinking I would remember. And he just looks at me on stage. He just literally looked at me, and I'm at the piano, and I just literally looked at him and looked at the audience, and I took the music and I flipped the page over very slowly, and I started playing again. So the audience realized I had made a mistake, but it was like, oh, oops.
And what did he say? I'm just curious.
We just laughed.
He didn't like reprimand you or say anything.
Oh no, not at all.
That doesn't happen, or it does happen.
No one has ever really reprimanded me. Really, here's a great backstage story. One of the first shows I did with Lucy Arnaz years ago was in Italy. She got called to do 90 minutes of Irving Berlin, and she had never done a nightclub act before. She'd always, you know, she'd been on Broadway and They're Playing Our Song and then Seesaw. She had always, you know, been in Broadway shows and musicals, but she had never done a nightclub act. And so we're going to about the third or fourth number in, and she turns and she walks upstage and she gives me a look like, I thought, what did I do? It was like one of those, Jesus, what? I didn't know what was going on. So at intermission, I went up to her and I said, did I offend you? Did I do something wrong? And she said, what? And I said, you turned around and you gave me a look, and she stopped for a second and she goes, no, she says, my brain was going, stop playing. She had never been in a concert where she had to just keep going. Like usually on stage, somebody else talks, somebody else does this. This was like all her. And she said, she realized, like, she finished the number and she came up and she goes, oh God, I've got to do another number right now. And she was like, it was fear in her eyes. It wasn't reprimand. It was like, well, she said, I kept thinking, stop playing. I can't think.
Jeff, do you have more connection with some performers? I mean, because I saw you do a nightclub act with Lucy, and I could tell, like, there was kind of like a back and forth between the two of that. It was like a, almost like a dance between her, your music and what she was doing. And even if she, like, yeah, she was talking about something, you threw in a few notes in so she could do a little tap dancing,
right,
and an unexpected moment, at least unexpected to the audience. Is it like ESP between some performers or others? Like, I have no idea what this person's thinking, or is it all the same for everybody? I mean,
Lucy,
what's that like?
With Lucy and me, Lucy and I have been together like 30 years now. We've been performing together for 30 years. So ever since she had a nightclub act, I've been with her. So we know, and we also have very similar senses of humor. Do you know what I mean? We have of a single mind of what we're doing. And like when we start an arrangement, it's always about what do you want from this song? Is it an emotional thing? You know, where are you? What's the way? And that's how the arrangement starts out. It's like, don't play as much in between here because I need to, like, she wants a feeling of solitude. You know what I'm saying? If it's a ballad or something,
right,
like that. But so we talk about all that stuff beforehand. And once the general gist is there, we have the freedom to go any place else because I know what she's taught, what she wants to do. Do you know what I mean? And
yeah,
we're very, very simpatico in that.
But other performers, not so much, or
not that it's not so much. It's just that it's always, you know, since I've been with her for so long, it's a very special bond. Valerie Pettiford, who's a phenomenal jazz singer, and I have a great rapport. And it's, in some ways, it's almost just more music-based than it is Lucy and I with an emotionality-based. Valerie and I have a great musicality compadre thing together. Michelle Lee and I actually have another great time. She's another one with very similar sense of humor. And she and Lucy are great friends. So it just makes it everything. I've been very fortunate in that there's only one person that I didn't enjoy my full time with.
Oh, we need to know.
No, here's the thing. For some reason, this is maybe not really true, because I played for, but most of my work is with female artists as opposed to men. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if that's a thing where between my hair and everything, men don't feel as comfortable with me on stage. But this one person that I didn't, not that I didn't get along with, it wasn't as much fun because he was not that giving of a performer. He was a very selfish performer.
Uh-huh.
And didn't like the fact that I rode in the front of the plane with him in first class, because that was in my contract, because he thought he should be the only one there. You know what I mean? It's like just one of those things. Yes. But that's it. And I stayed with that person for like 6 months. When I first got the job, I had been warned about doing it, and called my lawyer, and he said, well, my lawyer said to me, what would it be worth for you to take it? What would you want financially? And what would, you know, so I told him the stuff. So a few days later, he called me. He said, I have good and bad news. I said, yes. He goes, the good news is they said yes to everything you wanted. The bad news is you have to start next week. And I was like,
oh, no.
Okay. But I lasted for 6 months, and then it was just like, it didn't work. But I was not the first person to have said this about this other person.
So, Ron, how have, I mean, you know, we're going to have a lot of, you know, young emerging artists listening to this podcast. Mm-hmm. How, I mean, I know you always say luck, 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 but, you know, people make their luck. But I really would love you to try to get into the essence of why you think you've had such an amazing career in it, you know, in entertainment. I mean, you may not be able to stand on the corner of 33rd and 3rd and say Ron Abel and everyone's going to know your name.
Correct.
Yet you have managed to make a, you know, a fine living, maybe a lavish living, you know, doing what you do. And what is the secret of success in entertainment? If you can't say secret, like as close as you can get, so aspiring people understand what the road ahead is.
Well, for me, the secret to success is people just liking your work. It's not always financial. I mean, I work with a lot of people because I get a lot of work because people like what it is that I do. And as you say, I may not be a household name, but my name in the industry is very good because I do a particular kind of arrangement and orchestrations for people that's based more on the lyric of the song than it is the musicality. I will, you know, it's always about what is the lyricist saying, and then you take the song and you work the arrangement. In other words, you don't always say, I need a swing arrangement here. You say, what do you want to say at this point in the act? I mean, I approach things, I guess, very differently, almost from an acting background as opposed to like a sideman. You know, I don't do like sets for people. I'm not one of those people who grew up doing three shows a night in a band. I never did that. And I think that's a different mindset. So I always approached it more from where the performer's coming across as an actor.
Have there been people that disagreed with your arrangements?
There are people who have said that I go too far in changing something sometimes. In other words, that if it's a song from the 30s and I give it a different spin, that it was written in the 50s, or if I take an Irving Berlin song and treat it as if it was a Stephen Sondheim song in how I arrange it, people, there are the purists who will go, but that's not what the composer meant. Well, that's my job as an arranger, is to make it new and fresh for a new audience so mm-hmm. that they relate to it.
So how much of a debate is that? What happens?
It's never a debate. I mean, the one thing I did say to somebody one time was, look, you hired me to do this. If you don't like it, what I'm doing, then you should get somebody else.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's the truth. It's like, I'm not going to do something just because you want it.
Mm-hmm.
And fortunately, I don't have to do that. If I don't like, you know, the way something's looking, I can just bow out or something and say, no, get somebody else.
Mm-hmm.
Ron,
because it's not, yes.
I was going to say, is it also part of, do you prefer being in, like, you the piano and the performer, or you the piano, a full band orchestra behind you, and the performer? That seems
God.
Like a very different experience. Which, you know, when it comes to, because arranging obviously gets way more complicated with a whole lot of other pieces in the music. Does that...
Yeah.
Well,
I mean, it's which of your children do you like the best? It's Sophie's choice. It's really a hard thing to say. I mean, when I'm alone with a performer on stage, it's magic because it's very funny. We were just, Lucy and I were doing the show at 54 Below, and it's called Lucy Arnaz, I Got the Job, Songs from My Musical Past. And it's a retrospective of what she's done in theater. Mm-hmm. And it's just her and me. There's no band, there's no nothing. And right before we went out on opening night in New York, she turned to me and she goes, "This is really brave." She said, "Just you know, you and me and the piano." And I just turned to her and I said, "Yeah, but we're a lot." She and I, we got to say, "But we are. We're a lot. I mean, just her and I together are a lot, and that's very fortunate." The other thing is that, like, I've done symphony. I get to conduct symphonies every once in a while with people of arrangements that have orchestrations that I've done. And again, right now I mentioned Lucy just because she was the one who turned to me. We were with the Philly Pops one time and in the middle of a concert. And she just, after like one of the numbers, she turned and on mic, she turned to me and she said, "They're paying us for this. You realize that?" Because there's nothing like having a 60-piece symphony there playing stuff that you've done. I mean, in some ways it's a lot harder for me because you're leading 60 people and they're all looking to you for like what to do, and it's like, okay, there are pressures on there. But once you get through like the first second number and you realize it's going to be fine, then you can enjoy it. Then you can really enjoy it, and it's just heaven. Always take your drummer with you. That's the thing. Lucy and I always take your drummer because, especially with a big symphony, you want to make sure that you got the bassist right with you. Yeah.
Right.
So
that
Ron,
makes a lot of
Ron,
sense.
Yeah. So
yes.
Ron, you said it's the performance, of what you've done, and people like what you do. There are many actors and actresses, or singers, magicians, that are not that great yet have had a long-standing career, and there are other people that are so talented that can't get a job.
Yeah.
So what is it? What is the secret of what you do? So yes, so there's no question about it. People like what you do, but what else is in the motion of what you do or how you attack the career that people that are starting out should know so that they could survive and make enough money to sustain themselves?
First of all, I think the truth is just be nice. People want to work with people that they want to spend time with. My drummer, Steve Samuel, says, truly, when you realize it's as much about the hang as it is being on stage. In other words, you don't want to walk out on stage and make music with people that you don't get along with. That's a job.
Mm-hmm.
And you never want to think about what we do in making music as a job. It's one of the luckiest things
in the
world.
I wish more people in the world recognized that everybody has a job to do. And if everybody was, nice and civil to other people, it would make all of our lives so much better. So that's.
But it makes your own life better.
Yeah,
it makes your own life better.
Absolutely. I agree.
So, Ron, I mean, when someone's starting out, I mean, like, when you started out, didn't you have to audition?
My first, here's a backlash. Years ago, when Godspell was first around, that was my first professional job. Was I was the musical director for the national tour. First the bus and truck, and then the national tour, then came into New York. But I originally auditioned for the show, to be in the show, because I was out of college and everything. And I played for the girl's audition right before my audition. And after her audition, I sat down and started to play for myself, to sing for my own thing. And I got about 8 bars into the song, and they stopped me. And in my brain, I went, really? I was that bad? It was that. And literally, the guy behind the desk said, excuse me, would you be interested in musical directing this tour? That was literally it. And I went, I wanted to audition. And then he told me what the pay was for the musical director as opposed to the actor. And I went, okay, I'll take it. And it was before cell phones and everything. And I literally left that day, drove back to where I was living in Westchester with my folks. And I had no, I couldn't tell anybody that I just literally got a job. Wow. I was very lucky. That's how my musical director career started.
Wow.
Yeah.
So what suggestion, so you have to say be nice, and what else? I mean, do they just have to keep going, or when is it time
to
give up?
It's hard for me, because I would never give up. I'd have nothing else to do. What would I do? Mm-hmm. I was so lucky in that I always worked, I don't have a family really that I had to provide for. So even if there were leaner times, it was just me. Mm-hmm. I didn't have to worry about that. That would probably change how I felt if I was married and had a family and all that. That would probably, yes, have affected how I approach stuff. It probably would have made me a little bit harder edge, because I don't have that. I don't have the thing that really I have to get ahead and keep moving forward and the upgrade to everything. I just don't have that in me.
I think that's so true for if you don't have a wife and little mouths looking up at you that depend on you to, you know, for being for providing for them, it takes some pressure off of you and gives you the ability to take a gamble and do something else with your life. So I think that makes a lot of sense.
I mean, I have really good friends, really, really wonderful musicians who've had to go out and do something else because they have a family of 2 or 3 kids and a wife, and that's their number one. You know what I mean? That becomes your number one, and that's the way it is. That's true. If you're just alone, your number one is your career.
Right.
Here's another quick, great little showbiz story. A bunch of years ago, I was musical director for David Foster, a big record producer and composer. He had written a musical with a man by the name of Arthur Janoff, who wrote the book. Arthur Janoff was the head, the guy who invented scream therapy, mm-hmm. primal scream therapy. Yeah, and they were doing a musical about it. So David hired me to be musical director for it. And I went to David's house, and we were doing a pre-production thing. And I walked in, and he and Arthur Janoff were in a huge fight. And David just turned to me and he said, what's more important to you, career or love? And I went, career. And Arthur Janoff says, you're wrong. And I said, don't tell me what's wrong. And that's the same argument David was having with him. David is such a career-driven person, which is why he's been married 4 times, probably. You know what
exactly,
I mean?
Exactly. Yes.
But his career is number one to him, and that's, you make a decision. I mean, that's, I'm no good to anybody else if I'm not happy in my career.
Right.
Steve feels exactly the same way, and I feel the same way. And sometimes people look at us like, you selfish son of a bitches.
Well,
absolutely.
Then I'm selfish.
Every person prioritizes their own life their own way, and that's what you have to do. But speaking of David Foster, I saw Kristen Chenoweth the other night performing.
Oh, how was it? I didn't get to go see it.
Amazing. But sitting 2 rows in front of me and to the right was David Foster and his new wife. I can't remember her name. The one from
Catherine
America.
Catherine McPhee.
Yeah, it was right there. So they were, and of course she had them stand up and all that, so it was very nice. But so you mentioned him, and I thought I'd tie that into this.
Oh yeah, no, and he's a brilliant man, and I was thrilled when he asked me to be the musical director because we have a similar way of approaching stuff. You know what I mean? That's why he hired
me. That's wonderful. So Ron, what is the magical moments of your career? I mean, you know, you said something before that I could relate to and Steve can relate to. We've often discussed it about euphoria, like, you know, when Lucy turns around and says, oh my God, you know,
they're paying us for this. Yeah.
So we have had, Steve has had unbelievable success in his career of, you know, of being on air and, you know, representing companies all over the world and traveling. And, you know, and, you know, I just, you know, if I get a hit in a newspaper, it's like I'm 18 years old, you know, getting an article that I produced, and it's great. So so you explained, like, you know, being on stage, but was there one magical scenario that you could tell us about that really sums it up?
Oh boy. Probably not, because fortunately the joy and the moments keep coming. Do you know what I mean? It's like,
how about your musical, you know, Hazel in Chicago being produced? I mean, that was huge.
Of course, that was huge. That was
huge.
That was huge. Just getting something on like that. I mean, if you're in the business, you know how hard it is to get anything to move forward of a musical of that size. So that was thrilling. I had another show called Twist of Fate in Los Angeles that ran for 6 months that I wrote with Lissa. I was at the theater every night. I think I never missed a performance of it because watching the audience's reaction, there's the euphoria, watching an audience's reaction to something you've either written or created or you play, and they get it. So that euphoria comes almost anytime you're on stage, if you're lucky that people like what you do.
Listen, when Hazel was in Chicago, or you had the readings for Hazel in New York at a studio, my head was looking at you and Chuck, watching you watch your show rather than watching the show. Because to me, that was like moments that people don't get, watching the creators and the producers actually see their baby, you know, being given birth. So I found that absolutely fascinating. And I saw the whole body language and everything, and you both look like you had like electricity coming out of you.
Well, yeah, because part of that is fear. when you're sitting there watching it, because literally, like with Hazel, because I wasn't playing it, I had somebody else musical directed, I wrote it. So literally, once that curtain goes up, you're done. You can't stop it. You can't fix it. You know what I mean? So you have to just like give it up to the gods, and people were enjoying it. So that, of course, is great. But what you probably saw in us was like, oh God, is this going to be okay? That kind of body language.
That's amazing. So just before we wrap this up, what are you working on now? What should our listeners hear about you? Where can they find you?
Oh boy. Well, I'm still touring with Lucy. I'm touring with the guy by the name of Willie Falk, who was the original Chris in Miss Saigon, who's a doll. I'm having a great time with him.
But you have so many dates in the ending 2019 to 2020. I mean, you're like solidly booked.
Thank God. Yeah. Yeah. And I just got a call recently, Jolie Fisher, you know who Jolie is. We've been doing an act that they may now book us in Australia for the theater for a little bit. She was telling me, I went, okay, well, just
amazing.
Let me know if that's the dates. And then let you know. So fortunately, I keep going. I just sort of like let the calendar fill up, and hopefully it's like this winter here in New York, I'm away every week during the winter, at least for a week every month in the winter in a warm climate. I'm going to Hawaii with Willie Falk. I go to California a couple times with Lucy, and then Florida. So it's like, yeah, life is good.
That's what's wonderful.
That's great. I love hearing that. Who doesn't want to get away from the cold here? I'm in New York, frightened of the cold, but that's why we're lying on the beach. So we're too far from warm weather.
when we moved here full time, because you know Chuck and I moved back to New York full time around 5 years ago, after living both places for about like 8 years or so, I realized that in today's world and with what I do, it's really just a base because I still travel a lot of the time, and New York is just fabulous now. You know, I never thought I'd move.
He ran
back
away
here, but...
from it, and now he rediscovered, you know, his hometown is fabulous.
Yeah, yeah.
Before we go, I do want to say that Ron and Chuck live in a place in Hell's Kitchen. It's considered Hell's Kitchen or Clinton?
Yes, it is.
Hell's Kitchen, which has really become ground zero for the entertainment world. I'm not going to say the address because I don't want people to show
Thank
up
you.
There. But it's really ground zero because, you know, I lived in New York for most of my life. And now I'm in Miami Beach, and I watch through Facebook everybody posting pictures from Ron and Chuck's home and their outside area. I'm not going to give too much more away. And it's kind of like the place where everybody hangs, and I see very successful people there with major names, and I see people that can't find a job, but everybody finds a home with Ron and Chuck, and I think that in itself almost should become a play or a movie or a book because it's, you know, I go there as an outsider and I love being an outsider watching human nature take place within, you know, this round table that Chuck and Ron have created. And I'm watching people and everyone is so wonderful to each other. And it's like if the world could be like that, the way everybody is helpful and accepting and friend and celebrating each other, whether it's a personal milestone or it's something they've done, you know, in the world of, you know, performance. It's an amazing phenomenon. And I just wanted to thank you, Ron and Chuck, for that, because you created a stage in your own home.
Well, the thing is, when we found this place, it was literally the moment we walked through it, I went, oh yeah, I could live here, because it's the kind of a place you always dream of when I was a kid about, if you're going to live in New York, this is what you want to do.
Right.
And the moment I saw it, I was like, yeah, let's do this, because it's just, it has a, we, never mind. It was we had a tenant before we moved in here. We had somebody live here. The place was brand new, but it was, you know, and how the place was bought. And that's why we had a tenant. Anyway, he offered to buy it from us before we moved. You know, we're coming in. We said, no, I'm sorry. My bags are packed and I'm sitting outside the door. And he said to us, he said, there's something very special. He said, you're going to be very happy here. There's just something about this place that is just so, you feel like you have a home as opposed to an apartment in New York.
Right.
And
you
exactly
share it,
how it feels.
And you share it with others, which is wonderful.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
A lot of people that go there, you know, maybe I'm slightly exaggerating, but I don't think so. Your place is their social life. And without it, they would have a very dull or maybe depressing life. But you're always giving hope there.
I don't think they'd have a dull life. I think it's just here you have enough space to relax and enjoy it.
Well, I think that, like, you know, knowing, like, you know, a friend of mine has an art gallery. And when we go there, we know, like, that's like Cheers. Everybody knows your name. And it's a place where
right.
It's like a church or a synagogue. You know, it's like, you know, that's a great part of your life. So it's so enjoyable to know that no matter what else you do during the week, you're going to end up there. And, like, that's okay. Life is good. So I think you should be commended. And Chuck, you know, for opening up your arms to so many people to come in and enjoy what you have.
It's just that we love it, too. But we love it, too. It's not to be commended. It's because we like it, you know.
Well,
we like having the people
on. Steven Robert want to be invited. So.
Oh, Steven, you have my number.
I'll walk over there because I don't live too far from there. But anyway, I think this is a good place for us to wrap this up. Do you agree, Lois?
Yes.
Okay, so
thank you so much,
Ron. Thank you so much. This was wonderful getting a little insight into the life of a musical maven. And on that note, I'm going to say I'm Steve Greenberg with
Lois Whitman Hess,
and we have all been lying on the beach.
Thank
so
you
long.
So much.
Bye. Thank you.